Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. My guest today is Derek Katzen, Professor of History at the University of Texas of the Permian Basin. Derek has just published a fascinating book about the 1981 South African Rugby Union Tour of the United States, which is called Flashpoint: How a Little-Known Sporting Event Fueled America's Anti-Apartheid Movement. That Springbok tour is almost forgotten today, but Derek brings it to life by talking about the sometimes bizarre details of the tour. For example, touring squad members who weren't selected to play against the United States weren't even told the match was taking place, but also sets the tour in the broader politics of apartheid and the Cold War that was the context of much of rugby politics at the time. It's a fascinating read that opens up a new window on the reality of rugby union under apartheid and in the decades immediately before the game went professional in 1995. So, welcome to the show, Derek.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
I guess the place to start is to ask you why the mighty Springboks felt the need to play against the then rugby minnows of the USA.
It was really an any port in a storm situation. The decade and a half before that had pretty much seen every place the Springboks went, they met with real big protests. And, you know, a tour of Wales, Scotland, England in 69-70, a tour of Australia in 1971 led virtually all of those unions to say, nope, we might play with you, but we're not gonna host you here. And so for the Springboks, it became a matter of tied in with a whole host of things going on in the 1970s in terms of propaganda that they were trying to do is they're trying to win allies. They're trying to win friends. And so the rationale for them to come to the United States was, well, they'll have us. They'll play us. And the prospect of it was seemed absurd when first mentioned. And before long, they're like, yeah, let's do it. And then it became even more probable when Australia not only said, no, we're not playing you anymore. They said, no, you're not flying through Australia to get to the United States. And no, you're not flying over our air or to get to New Zealand when they're going to the big New Zealand tour. And then no, you're not even flying over our airspace. And that suddenly made things a whole lot more difficult. So there's the any port in a storm part. And then there's just the travel pragmatics of the whole thing that Springboks were already going halfway around the world and couldn't get any sort of way to land in Australia. So that was part of it. And then from the American vantage point, it's a little more obvious, right? My goodness, we can play maybe the best rugby union on earth, or at worst, the second best. Let's do it. So from the American vantage point, there was an element of both, hey, let's help build our sport, and naivete. And then on top of it all, there was this sort of small but vocal American component that if they didn't support apartheid per se, they didn't not support apartheid. You know, that's the whole Reagan thing. Like Reagan said apartheid was evil and then continued to sort of engage in constructive engagement and engage in, you know, talking about South Africans as friends and allies who fought with us in wars and so on and so forth. And so, you know, from the American side, it was, we can play who? You know, it would be like your local club team finding out they could play Manchester United. I mean, you know what's going to happen, but you're still willing to do it. For South Africa, it really was a, we'll play anyone who will play us, and it'll be good for publicity. And, you know, well, to heck with Australia, to heck with traveling to the UK.
Because, as you mentioned briefly there, immediately before the tour to the States, the Springboks had been on probably the most controversial tour in the entire history of rugby when they toured New Zealand. And yeah, it's a commonly used phrase, although it's somewhat exaggerated, but it gives you a sense of the times that New Zealand was basically on the verge of civil war over the Springboks tour in 1981.
Yeah, I mean, and when you do so, when you do something like write a book like this, you end up having to pick up an entirely new, you know, historiography. I hope that's not too history tech stuff, but and so I got to learn a lot about New Zealand. And the only thing that even compares is like general strike in the World War One era. And even then, I mean, this still brings up, like, there have been fiction set in the 1981 tour. There have been a whole host of things. It is this major cultural moment. And I would argue not only the most controversial tour in the history of rugby union, I think that's pretty much settled fact. I think it might be the most controversial sporting event or series of sporting events in the history of sport. And it was just everywhere the Springboks went, it was going to be chaos, because in New Zealand, these guys are known quantities, right? Nas Bota is not walking down the street in New Zealand without 1,000 people recognizing him. You know, these Springboks are not, you know, Donnie Gerber is not walking down the street without being recognized. And that wouldn't be the case in the US if we're not trying to put the cart before the horse. But so in New Zealand, every place they met, they went, whether it was the midweek matches, because this was like proper touring era too. We don't see this anymore, right? But this is the time when the Springboks were there for 56 days and they played almost 2 dozen times. So, you know, they had the 3 test matches, but they also played provincial sides. They played what Americans would call all-star teams. They played, you know, all these select groups. So they were playing twice a week with the 30 guys or so that they brought. And so, I mean, every single place they went, they met with protests. They met with police clashing with the protesters. They met with, you know, protesters trying to get onto the grounds. They had one match canceled. I mean, it was absolute crazy and absolute chaos, so that they almost thought it would be calm waters when they got to the United States. And relatively speaking, it was, but it was still a continuation when they got to the US.
Again, it's an amazing contrast, because they're in New Zealand where effectively Springboks versus All Blacks is seen as the real world rugby championship. Even before the World Cup, it was kind of the unofficial championship of the world. So the Springboks go from New Zealand, which is, as everybody knows, rugby union mad, to the States. So what was the state of rugby in America at that time?
There wasn't really much of one. There was, yes, a national team that they pulled together from guys who played at clubs, guys who'd played at just a handful of colleges where rugby was played. In some ways, the true spirit of amateurism. You know, the U.S. rugby could always rely on the fact that they'd won the 1920 and 1924 gold medals in rugby, the last time rugby union had been played, and the last time it'll ever be played in the Olympics. The sevens game is the only game that's even viable in a 2-week span. It was, if we think there's a gap between first tier nations and second and third tier nations now, the gap between first and second tier nations in 1981 was immense. It was absolutely just a gulf that is almost unimaginable to think about. Now, it doesn't mean that the players who played weren't passionate, that they didn't embrace that same spirit that we all love about rugby of, you know, you beat the heck out of each other for 80 minutes and then you go out on the and drink beers together and all that. But there was no earthly reason for the Springboks to be playing in the United States, except for the political questions. I mean, anybody who would say keep politics out of sports fundamentally would misunderstand why the Springboks were in the US to begin with.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that you bring out really well in the book, is that it's kind of the tour itself is intimately connected to what's going on in the States at the time. So it's on the day of Ronald Reagan's inauguration as president that the actual invitation to the Springboks, the formal invitation to the Springboks, goes out, and that itself is making a statement, isn't it?
Yeah. So some people propose the tour, they're like, well, I don't think Carter will give you visas. His policies aren't very friendly to South Africa, even though they were hardly unfriendly to South Africa. You know, Carter was no, you know, as much as we talk about his human rights, Carter didn't do a darn thing really to undermine apartheid South Africa. But Reagan was, especially in 1980-81, actively a friend. I think as the anti-apartheid movement progresses, he at least recognizes the biggest problems, though he doesn't really budge much. He was stubborn, much like Margaret Thatcher was. But there was an understanding that if we try to do this under Carter, there's almost no chance it'll happen. Whereas if we try to do it under Reagan, it'll absolutely happen. So the changing politics is vitally important in understanding this, because Democrats were not great on this issue, but there were Democrats that were. Congressional Black Caucus, some of the stronger liberals in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. But it was going to be a sea change. And some of the early people who proposed the tour recognized that explicitly. Look, Reagan's going to win this election, then you'll have a friend in the White House. You saw a lot of that.
Yeah, and conversely, from the South African point of view, it was seen, for the South African government anyway, it was seen as a, not so much a covert, but maybe a soft acknowledgement of their legitimacy. Because at the same time this was happening, I think that August 1981, South Africa invaded Angola as well. So it was almost as if there's a kind of, the American government is nodding its head towards South Africa.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, the other thing to keep in mind, though, is that the global anti-apartheid movement is not in its infancy. That wouldn't be fair. There were people who opposed apartheid from the 50s. And in the wake of Sharpeville in 1960, the massacre in which 69 were killed and untold dozens, despite the official figures, were wounded, global anti-apartheid sentiment really exploded. Then in the wake of the Soweto uprisings in 1976, it explodes again, but it's much stronger in places that have other connections, the Commonwealth, for example. So those nations are paying more attention. The United States tends to be a little bit removed on the apartheid thing. Yes, you'd had college students as early as the 1970s calling for divestment. But I mean, the real explosion of America's attention span to the apartheid question is going to come in really in 84, 85, 86, when the country kind of explodes in these paroxysms of violence and where, you know, it becomes a nightly. I mean, you know, I was a young teenager when a lot of the 84, 85, 86 stuff is happening. And South Africa was suddenly on the nightly news every night in the United States. It wasn't in 1981 when the Springbok tour comes. Even though it becomes a national news story, the contextualization for it is much smaller. So most people would have been asking, what's the big deal?
But also, I think, again, one of the things you draw out in the book is that there was also a kind of, and I think you mentioned it early on, there was a, maybe if not open support of apartheid, there was a sympathy for apartheid, or at least a tolerance of it within American rugby, as there was in much of, you know, this is not to deny that people did protest against it within rugby, but certainly in the leadership of the game, there was, to say the least, a tolerance of it.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, for one thing, this is where you get to the issue that the rugby world is really quite small and Commonwealth dominated. And so just in that sense, if you take out South Africa, then you've taken out, you know, for New Zealand, you've practically taken out the only team worth playing on a regular basis from a vantage point of the Northern Hemisphere teams, you know, one of the handful outside of a very short traveling range that you can play. I mean, South Africa was vitally important to international rugby in a way that they weren't important to FIFA, in a way that they weren't important to the Olympic movement, in a way that they were more important in cricket. It's very comparable, but in rugby, there was no question that, you know, this is the best team on earth or the second best team on earth. We could fancy ourselves better than them at any given time, might say England or might say Wales. But realistically, you know, no one was going to get rid of him. New Zealand wasn't going to. And the IRB sort of left it up to individual unions. So unlike FIFA, which said bye-bye, unlike the IOC, which said bye-bye, unlike almost every sports code. I mean, even at ridiculously low, you know, like games, you know, board game international bodies that no one even knew existed excluded South Africa. And, you know, World Rugby basically left it up to individual unions, and individual unions continued to play. And I mean, you know, the Lions toured in 74 and then toured again in 1980, right? So in terms of like the power nexus of rugby, they not only turned a blind eye, they continued to play.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of the context. What actually happened on the ground? What happened when the Springboks arrived? Because clearly, again, as you mentioned in the book, there's an organised campaign that begins against them, against apartheid and against sporting links with apartheid. You know, the slogan was no normal sport with an abnormal society. So how was the tour organized? What were the mechanics of it?
So the plan was that they were going to do two, you know, they weren't literally like the midweek match kind of thing. They were going to play a Midwestern All-Star team. It was going to be in Chicago. And then they were going to play an Eastern All-Star team in New York. And then they were going to play the Springboks. And in the United States, there was a fairly ardent but small anti-apartheid community just made of exiles. Right. So Dennis Brutus, the famous poet and the famous anti-apartheid sports campaigner, is based in the United States. I mean, he'd been at what is now Worcester State University and then ended up at Northwestern. And in fact, ironically enough, the U.S. government is trying to shut down his visa while all of this is happening, which is really quite ironic, given that they claim they should not have this political connection to visas. And it was going to be small. Like the one thing the Springboks were all saying, the touring party, the players, et cetera, is that, well, whew, we're done with New Zealand. We're done with this chaos. And the American protests wouldn't rise to the level of New Zealand. But it turns out that there were campaigners, Jesse Jackson and his Rainbow Push Coalition were ardently vocal against him playing in Chicago. And so the Chicago City Council prohibits them from playing. And they end up playing at the secret site in Racine, Wisconsin, that leads to all this bizarre legerdemain. And I think some of the maybe the more compelling parts of the book are this ridiculous story in the Midwest where you're like, in order to get to the game, because they're trying to evade protesters, right? The funny thing is, the protesters could surround the Chicago Athletic Association where they're staying. But if the Springboks could somehow evade those protesters surrounding, or not even surrounding, just at one part of the building, if they could be clever enough to go out another exit, they could walk down the streets of Chicago in their green blazers, which seems like a foolish thing to do after New Zealand, but and not even be known. People be like, are you guys a circus troupe? Because you don't necessarily have the giants. You might have a few big guys, but you'd also have a lot of, you know, Nas Bota isn't physically imposing to anyone. And a lot of these guys aren't. They could walk down the streets of Chicago and no one would know who they were, right? And so it was bizarre in the sense that those who know were going to cause trouble and engage in protests. But in the larger community, no idea who the Springboks were, what a Springbok was, what rugby was. I mean, just no clue. So that they go surfing in Hawaii. They go visit Disneyland in Anaheim. They go and they do their practices on the beach of Lake Michigan. But where the protests are is really problematic and vocal. So they play this match in Racine. And there's a story that you have to tell it because it's too good not to tell, even though this wasn't the experience of the majority of people. But in order to avoid journalists and protesters, they did this whole thing where, at least for some small group of people, you had to find a, and if I get the details of my own book wrong, I apologize, but like you had to find a green Oldsmobile at a rest stop in Chicagoland, but in southern Wisconsin. And then if you pulled up to the passenger window, you'd say, are you Checkpoint Charlie? And if you did that and then they responded and you responded, then you'd get told where the game was. And they ended up playing this Midwestern All-Star team and getting like halfway through a match, but they decided to play the match on a field that was adjacent to the Black community, because of course American communities still were dealing with segregation issues de facto, if not de jure. And the protesters found it, and it became a nightmare. And part of the reason that there were still protesters to find it is that the newspaper in Racine, Wisconsin was writing about this for days, weeks, and months leading up to it, you know. And with the debate, it's amazing how the anti-apartheid debate when it comes to sports plays out kind of the same everywhere, right? Sports and society should be separated. They shouldn't have anything to do with one another. Let them play. And then the other side, all the criticisms of apartheid. Obviously, I come down on that side of it. I think I'm less harsh to the players than I am to the people organizing the tours and the politicians and all that, and the Americans who invited them and so forth. You know, in some ways the players are 22, 23, 24, 28 years old and do just want to play rugby. But the Wisconsin, Chicago and Wisconsin situation kind of sets the tone. And suddenly the Springboks realize, well, this isn't going to be the holiday we necessarily thought.
So how did the American press respond to this? Because it seems, you know, from a distance, it would seem it's kind of bizarre that here's this game that, you know, very few people in the States are interested in. And yet all of a sudden it's blown up to become this big political issue. But then there's also this kind of strange cloak and dagger stuff going on at the same time. Was the press interested in it at all?
In some places they were. And as the tour progressed in the United States, it became bigger. So, yeah, the Racine newspaper, the Chicago newspapers are covering it. Occasionally it would get a write-up in a major national newspaper. But in like, you know, those stories on page 7 that take up 2 column inches and were clearly pulled from an AP or UPI sort of feed. You know, you'd get a lot of that kind of thing. The major national newspapers would pick up on it. The television media would pick up on it when they were in the United States, but it was very much a slow bleed, right? It wasn't one of these things that was like major national news from the minute the Springboks arrived. It became a Chicago story and then gets picked up by elsewhere. It becomes a Racine story that gets picked up by elsewhere. And then when the tour is all said and done, it gets a page in Sports Illustrated. And so by the time they leave, it's a national news story that soon after disappears, but it does become a national or a national-ish news story. Now, pales in comparison to a whole host of others, but part of it, of course, is that it ties into Cold War politics, but also the debate over apartheid. So sort of two, on the one hand, racism bad, on the other hand, South Africa's allies against the commies, good. So there's that whole subtext the whole time as well, right? So, you know, you don't get the sort of halo of virtue, for example, around Nelson Mandela. In many circles, Nelson Mandela is a communist and a terrorist. Now, we know the story is far more complicated than that. We know the story around the ANC is far more important than that and complicated than that. But it was the way the Reagan administration and others could spin the narrative.
Did the Springboks actually make much of the fact that they for PR purposes, that they'd brought along a single black player? I think out of a squad of 30, there was just Errol Tobias, who had been on the New Zealand tour, who came. Did they make much of that? Was there an attempt to sort of say, well, you know, South Africa's changing and we're changing, which was the PR line that was used throughout the 70s? I was also interested that you quote Bob Buchanan, who the Midwest rugby activist, who we both know, I think. And Bob makes the point that you compare the Midwest representative team that played the Springboks, and they both looked exactly, they're both all white as well. In fact, maybe were there more black players on the Midwest team than the South African team?
I'm not sure. There's only
one. I can't remember. Bob made the point that it's not much difference, yeah.
No. There were, I mean, in the entire tour in the United States, I know they only played. So, for example, they made a big deal in one of them about the fact that one of the American players was Asian in the Midwestern side. And then they make a big deal, of the black player for the Eagles. But yeah, I mean, American rugby was enormously white. It the only place it was played in any meaningful numbers was prep schools, elite universities, and then a handful of other state universities that had legacies of doing it. But I mean, it was very small and very much a game of privilege, as it is in lots of places, by the way, right? I mean, we've talked about it. Now, let me talk a bit about Errol Tobias, because he's a really important figure. And I think that he was in one of those damned if you do and damned if you don't situations, because he got accused of being an Uncle Tom by folks who should have been allies, and he got accused of not belonging by folks who weren't going to trust that he belonged. There were two, we'll use the term black in the sense of how Steve Biko used the term black, right, to describe those that South Africans would have described as non-white. Because Errol Tobias and Abe Williams, who was on the management team, were both colored South Africans, colored with an official apartheid term, and one that is both, we know it's problematic, and yet today in South Africa, we refer comfortably to colored to differentiate from African or Indian or whatever. So it's a term that I had to fight through my editors to get them to understand that, no, using the term colored, capital C-O-U-R-E-D, is different from using colored, like, you're not correcting a bigot, right? And I had to explain to them, because they changed it throughout the entire text. And I had to be like, look, I'm going to miss some of these. You have to go and do your search to change them all, because you have the PDF and I want to make sure you get it right. But the problem was, Errol Tobias came from the Colored Rugby Federation that operated within apartheid structures and not within the sort of non-racial rugby world. So he already was suspect in some circles. And he got called an Uncle Tom an awful lot in New Zealand. He actually made his Springbok debut in another, an incoming tour that Ireland did, that also I have a chapter in the book on, where he makes his debut. And the interesting thing, and this is getting deep into the rugby playing weeds, right, is that Errol Tobias is the sort of, he can play multiple positions, but in most circumstances, he's going to be the backup to Nas Bota, who was at the time, you know, nicknamed Nasty Boot, the one of the game's great kickers, and not one of the game's great runners or scorers. I mean, in all first-class rugby, not just Springboks, but in his entire career for the Blue Bulls and elsewhere, I mean, he scored single-digit tries, right? Errol Tobias was much more a player for today's game, right, where a scrum half, fly half is expected to be able to play running rugby and not just simply distribute the ball and kick. But Tobias plays once in the two-match incoming tour against Ireland, makes his debut. And at that point, the New Zealanders are saying, he's the one to watch. You know, he's the one we need to watch out for. But he doesn't play any of the tests in New Zealand. He doesn't end up playing the tests in the U.S., but he absolutely is put out front. Look, They're not segregated. What are you talking about? They have a black player. And so he gets used, even though, let's be realistic, if there was going to be a black Springbok, they were going to come from a tradition that was perceived as being collaborationist. And he's only, you know, he's the first black Springbok when Chester Williams is so famous in the 1995 Invictus World Cup, right? He's only the third black Springbok. And to talk about how insular that community is, the second black Springbok was Avril Williams, Chester Williams' uncle, right? So the first three are these colored South Africans from the Western Cape tradition, who in each example where they play end up being used, even if they also get their own out of it, right? Chester Williams becomes a sort of legitimate hero while also being put forth as the sole blackface of the Springboks. So he's a really important figure. He's contested on all sides, which is why, you know, I kind of feel bad for Errol Tobias. I get it. People who came from the non-rugby tradition are not sympathetic to my views on this. But I think it's okay to have a more sophisticated view about a young man who ultimately wants to play rugby, gets a chance to be the first black Springbok, something that, you know, the sort of legendary Donnie Craven had said would never happen, even though Craven ultimately brings him in. So, I mean, it's just a very complicated story. There are a lot of silly aspects, and there's the Checkpoint Charlie, but it's all covering up a really important and complicated story about race and politics and global anti-apartheid and South African anti-apartheid and so forth.
Let's move on to the climax of the tour, the actual test match between the US and the Springboks. That was rather unusual for a test match, to say the least, wasn't it?
It's the weirdest test match ever played. So there's a game against the Eastern All-Stars in Albany that they basically have to go to the courts to get these East Coast matches played. And the Supreme Court says they can, which, by the way, is probably the right decision based on, you know, the First Amendment and so forth. Like I hate the decision politically, but from the vantage point of understanding the First Amendment, it's true. The irony, of course, is that then in the two subsequent matches in the East Coast, they worked very hard to restrict protests. You can debate whether or not a rugby match is covered by the First Amendment. You cannot debate whether or not protests, political protest, is covered by the First Amendment. So there's a grand irony that the main guy organizing the tour is absolutely anti-protester, does everything he can to keep the protesters away. So the Eastern All-Stars play the Springboks, get suitably beaten, and then everything's building up towards the test match. The test match is supposed to be played in a traditional situation, you know, 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. Everything about it changes. They don't know where it's going to be played. The players don't know where it's going to be played. Only a tiny number of officials know where it's going to be played. They had wanted to play in Randall's Island, a stadium that still exists in New York City. And New York City's politicians say, nope, not going to happen here. So they move it back upstate. It ends up getting played in Glenville. Glenville is a rural community outside of Albany. And there are just the number of weird things happening. I'm going to forget some. But so it ends up being played in Glenville rather than in New York City. It ends up being played on a Friday morning, the only time the Springboks have ever kicked off in the morning locally. It ends up getting played on a polo field. Not only does it end up getting played on a polo field, it ends up getting played on a polo field that's on a distinct slope. Also, the primary athletes that play on a polo field aren't the rich white guys with the polo mallets. They're the horses. And horses tend to do their business wherever the business needs to be done. The players change in the paddocks where the horses normally are. Meanwhile, they haven't announced who the starting squads are going to be or anything. So half the squad gets brought up, goes on a road trip to Cooperstown in the Baseball Hall of Fame, where the other half does this whole cloak and dagger where they're not going to be seen, not going to be followed, and ends up at the polo field. By the way, that bred enormous resentment to the point where there might or might not have been a fist fight among the Springbok squad. Some describe it as just a wrestling match. Some describe it as a flat-out punch-up. A lot of resentment, especially since Errol Tobias, was one of those who was used as basically camouflage for the team, and also Rob Lowe. And Rob Lowe is fascinating. He's a white guy, incredibly talented player, but also the most publicly liberal of the white Springboks. Liberal, maybe better to think about it in the American sense of liberal, radical in the South African context. Errol Tobias, his best friend, and whose Springbok career was almost certainly cut short because of his politics. There's almost no question about it. They were very, very angry. Meanwhile, the match gets played, and the Springboks played, remember, they played 18 or 21 matches in 56 days in New Zealand. They played the two matches in the US. They have all this stuff going on. They're trailing early on, and the score is very low early on, also in no small part because the Springboks are the team going uphill in the first half. And the second half comes, and exactly what you'd expect happens. Well, meanwhile, they have one of the Springbok reserves manning the touchline. They put up the goalposts, but they put up the goalposts where American football is played, on the back of the goal touchlines. They don't have 22 meter lines. They don't have the field marked at all accurately. And so the whole thing is crazy. And then it's a test match that still holds the record for the fewest attendees, because there were 28. Because in the Albany match, the Eastern All-Star match, there had been a lot of protesters, and they had to fight like crazy to keep them out and to keep their distance. There had been a march from downtown Albany and City Hall to the stadium. That's where these guys really worked to keep protesters out in a big way. They had famous celebrities. So the biggest protest actually happens at the Eastern All-Star match, not at the Springbok match, because no one knows where the Springbok match is going to be. And people find out about it after the fact, including the Springbok players, who were furious, but also media and others. So it's just bizarre. The official attendance, I believe, was 28, which, again, the smallest number of people ever to see a test match amidst all these other bizarre circumstances. And in fact, the amateur rugby ethos is so strong that the player who manned the touchlines and served as basically the second official in the match wrote game reports. And he almost lost his eligibility to play rugby because some folks thought that was professionalizing it. The amateur ethos was so deeply ingrained that there were questions raised about him writing match reports. Why did he write match reports? Because no journalists were there. So it's just this bizarre thing. The Springboks end up, pounding them in an era where tries counted for less. It was on a muddy and frankly crap covered literal field. Everything about it is absurd. Like, the entire tour is absurd. And I try not to make too much of a joke of it, but I also try to point out how absurd it is in the book. While at the same time, it's a pretty serious issue, and the ramifications for the Springboks will be quite clear.
So after all that, what was the result? What was the legacy of the tour? Was there one? In a lot of ways, it sounds like it was something everyone would be glad to see the back of. But did it have any impact on what happened to the Springboks and the anti-apartheid struggle throughout the rest of the 1980s?
Yeah, definitely for the Springboks. So the Springboks find themselves persona non grata. This is the last tour. The last match they play outside of South Africa is this game on a polo field. They become isolated. Yes, they play in 1984. They get a visiting all-star team of South Americans to come in, and then England comes in, and then that's it. And there are major ramifications in a whole host of ways. So the Springboks are excluded from the first two World Cups at a time when, because of the World Cup and other things, rugby's really changing. So one of the sort of shocking components for the Springboks when they come back is, we're still the Springboks. We're going to be world beaters. We're going to be dominant. And they come back in 1992 and just, no, not against France, not against England, certainly not against Argentina, definitely not against New Zealand. The rugby world has kind of passed them by. And it was so funny. There was a kind of arrogance coming from South Africa anyways. And if those of you who follow rugby boards and all that, will find zero bit of surprise in all of that. But there were other aspects too. And I remember reading something about how South Africa was looking forward to getting back into the world of wine because their Pinotage was one of the great wine mixes in the world. And it turned out that South African Pinotage in 1992 was Swill. It's much better now. It's a wonderful wine now, but at the time it was, their wine was garbage. Their rugby team was garbage. Like every, you know, we're not the powerhouse that we thought we were. And in just half a decade or a little more, the world has really passed us by, including at this sport that we hold so dear, with a longer legacy than that, right? I mean, the reason the Invictus story, overstated though it is so inspirational is because of coming out of this apartheid period. For America, not really much. American rugby, folks would say it gave us legitimacy, No. American rugby was what it was, and their ability, you know, they played England soon after and got absolutely just waxed. American rugby just was what it was. And really, the only thing that American rugby would have going for it, as my camera, as my laptop says it's going to expire, is that it would qualify for every World Cup, because when you play in a region that isn't particularly good at rugby, you're going to get a relatively easy pass. Since 1981, the United States has played the Springboks. Have the scores in front of me, but I believe the first one was 44-30, and then 65-14, and then 65-0. I think, although the first two might be flipped, but haven't really gained much ground on the pitch, even as American rugby has gotten much, much better, right? And there are a whole host of reasons for that. I mean, very recently, MLR, the growth and expansion of sevens has meant that America can compete at that level, which becomes kind of a developmental thing. Just simply an improvement at the college level. So the college rugby occasionally gets on TV, especially the sevens. And then in the professional era, good players could go play somewhere else. So in some ways the gaps have closed, but in some ways they haven't, because for anything that professionalization did for America, well, think of what it does for, you know, right. So, I mean, you know, when the first time I played rugby, and just to make clear that I'm not taking any stolen glory, I played 1 year in South Africa and they put me on the wing where I could be the least disastrous possible. But the year I played, my head coach was a guy named Franz Erasmus, who played when South Africa played a World 15 team in 1989. He got his only cap then. And his nickname, he was Afrikaans from the get-go. His nickname for me was probably too profane for your podcast, and it played on my American heritage. But his nickname was Domkrach, which means Jack, because he was a mechanic. He owned an auto garage. And so Jack, he was a prop. So in the sense of, like, a jack creates tremendous leverage, Franz Erasmus did that. Really sad story a few years after that, but he was the head coach of the rugby club. And he ran the garage, not just because it was a passion of his, but because in the amateur era, they all had to have proper jobs, right? So, I mean, some of them were police, some were in the military, which was also one of the things people pointed out. They have nothing to do with the government. They have nothing to do with their policies. Well, except for the colonial policing model that South Africa pursued that had anybody in the police enforcing apartheid, except for in the military, where they enforced apartheid both domestically and then in what would become Namibia and in invading Angola and so forth, right? So, but then obviously a bunch of farmers, and then the old cliche about South African rugby was that that it was good luck that you always had to have at least one doctor. And you always said, this is really interesting, and talk about tying into complicated racial and ethnic politics, one doctor and one Jew, which is really interesting and shocking and eye-opening and raises questions about whiteness and all the kind of sometimes theoretical stuff I don't really get into, but just all this stuff going on. So that post-1995, sure, American rugby benefits, but boy, if you were playing in the provincial structures in Northern Transvaal, or if you were playing in the Western Cape, or if you were playing, I mean, talk about benefiting, because everybody on the Springboks is going to be, you know, the first pro chosen, whereas, you know, a few Americans, you know, I mean, I don't even know if every American Eagle now plays professionally. They probably do because of MLR, but not in 1997. Not in 1999, right? So it has, the game has changed enormously because of professionalization. The other thing that South African rugby has done is now suddenly 80% of the population that was excluded is included. So, you know, look, if this year, when they do the World Player of the Year, Lekanyo Am and Siya Kolisi and maybe Cheslin Kolbe aren't part of the conversation, then world rugby is asleep at the switch. I'm not saying they necessarily deserve to be. And I know that, you know, South Africa got third in the rugby championship, but they beat the Lions, which is still a big deal. And I mean, Khaleesi was a monster. Lekanyo Am might be the best center in the world. And you know, the Springboks won in 2007. They didn't have that many black players, but they had World Player of the Year, Brian Habana, right? And so with the Springboks being much more representative, haven't gone far enough, lots to do, but they're so much better than they would have been because they're bringing in more better players, right? So you have whether it's Beast, whether it's, you know, Chester Williams, still comes back to the fact that there are so many sporting options for the United States. It's hard to imagine the U.S. ever fully catching up, but who knows? Believe me, when it comes to my sports predictions, you probably wouldn't want to take it to the betting room.
Well, that's probably a good way, and probably true of mine as well, but that's probably a good place to stop what's been absolutely fascinating. You've managed to take us from 1981 all the way up to, pretty much this week. So thanks very much, Derek. That was really enjoyable.
Thank you.
And I hope listeners have enjoyed this episode as much as I have. Just to remind listeners, Derek's book is called Flashpoint, How a Little-Known Sporting Event Fueled America's Anti-Apartheid Movement. It's by Derek Katzum, and it's published by Roman and Littlefield. And if you want to follow Derek on Twitter, his handle is DC at Africa. As you may well know, my Twitter handle is at Collins Tony. My website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find a complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, together with show notes and links for this episode. So, until next month, thanks for listening.